Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Out to Lunch, the podcast where I positively encourage bad manners. Not only do I ask my guests to talk with their mouths full, but occasionally I tease out topics some might consider unsuitable for the dining table. Oh yes, living life on the edge. Today I chat to someone who is equally at home in a muddy field as she is at an award ceremony in a gown. Presenting everything from Glastonbury coverage to the BAFTAs, she's had Radio 1 shows, presented Top of the Pops, and has a podcast called Soundtracking, where she talks to filmmakers about musical influences in their work. My guest is the delightful DJ and broadcaster Edith Bowman.
I mean, doing small talk at the best times is hard. Doing small talk with Robert De Niro was like, what do you say? So then I was like, oh, I'll just tell him how much I embarrassed myself with Martin Scorsese. He just kind of nodded.
With the turned down mouth.
Yeah.
Hello there, Edith Bowman. I don't think we've ever met, have we?
No, we've definitely been in the same room at various points over the years, but never been officially introduced or had the pleasure of chatting. So nice to meet you.
Obviously, because you're in Gloucestershire and I'm in London, couldn't do the normal takeaway thing. So what I've done is I sent you a meal kit from a great American barbecue place called Smokestack.
Oh, my Lord. Even just the packaging is impressive.
It is pretty impressive. So this place, Smokestack, does a lot of American barbecue. They do 18-hour beef brisket and they do 15-hour pork belly ribs and slaw and beetroot stuff. And I loved it when I went. And David Carter, I said, could you possibly? And he went, yes, of course. So he has dispatched boxes in both our directions with a few cooking instructions, which I got a lovely emergency email from you about an hour ago going, which barbecue sauce?
Is it the honey one or the house one? I can't get it wrong.
Yeah. So have you done the beetroot and goat's cheese and hazelnut thing to begin?
I have it here.
Let's have a look. They're beautiful. So listen, the key to this is we do have lunch, even though it's in the slightly odd circumstances of a Zoom. So I'm going to invite you to start your starter and then I'll just bowl questions at you and you have to talk with your mouthful, which I'm sure is counterintuitive to a broadcaster of your experience.
There have been times.
Famously, you grew up pretty much in a hotel in Anstruther in Scotland.
Yeah.
It does seem a very long distance from the world you now occupy. That childhood, sometimes spending weekends with your grandparents so they could get on with running the hotel until you then went to work in the hotel. Mm. Was there any sort of hint of a media world in your family?
There was always music around the hotel, whether that was, you know, bands playing at weddings. We'd have this massive week of celebration over Hogmanay, where we'd have afternoon jazz bands playing, you know, while people had tea and cakes and stuff, or music playing, little acoustic nights going on in the bar. So there was always music. But my dad's got this amazing footage of me when I was 7 years old when we were on holiday. And on this one holiday, I remember my mum went up on the back of a speedboat, you know, one of those kind of parachutes. And my dad had a city camera. My dad always loved a bit of gadgetry. And he was filming mum and I had the microphone. Now, I was only seven and I sing the News at 10 theme tune. And then like, today, there's a lady up in a parachute. I think she's enjoying herself. And my dad kind of jokes about the fact that, you know, he kind of knew then that I was going to be talking about people and to people about whatever that may be.
So that was possibly your first broadcasting experience. If someone said to me, you know, describe Edith Bowman's work, I'd say she's a super fan. She's an absolute fan of the things that she talks about and interviews people about. For the tape, I will say that Edith is nodding.
That's really kind of you to say, to be honest, because that's all I ever kind of want to come across as, because I get a little bit kind of uncomfortable and get a twitchy eye when people describe me as a critic, because I'm not at all. I always come at things of being a fan. You know, I want a blank canvas and I want to make my own opinions about things. The music thing was my mum. She took me to my first concert when I was 7 years old to see Rod Stewart at Ibrox Stadium.
Oh.
She was a massive, wow. Still is, massive Rod fan.
Have you ever interviewed Rod?
Yes.
You have to tell me, but I want that from both sides. So you told him that he was your first gig?
Yeah, I told him it was my first gig. And then another time that we went to see him, I mean, it must have been the next year because I wasn't much older. We parked at this hotel because we knew it was easy to then just jump in a cab to the venue. And then we came back to get our car and we saw this big bus and Mum suddenly realised that Rod was staying at the hotel. Oh my God. Oh. So then we waited outside for about half an hour with our programme and he came out. And Mum kind of, she didn't push me, but she sort of ushered me towards him. She said, go and get him to sign your programme. So I kind of like bundled my way forward. This security guard kind of shunted me out the way, at which point Rod Stewart pushed him out the way and said, for God's sake, man, it's only a kid, and pulled me in and signed my programme.
Did you recall this with him?
Yes.
When you interviewed him?
Yeah.
And how nuts did your mum go when you said, by the way, this week I'm interviewing Rod Stewart?
I took her with me.
You took your mum with you to the interview.
But yeah, she was beside herself. It's one of the perks of the job, actually, of like being able to take, you know, my family or friends to things that, you know, we probably wouldn't have had the chance to do. Like my brother is the biggest Oasis fan in the world. And there's been maybe four or five occasions where he's met Liam through, you know, coming to festivals with me and stuff. And I mean, he's got this picture of him with Liam Gallagher that he's had, you know, like you can take pictures and have them painted onto canvas. He's had that done. Mum's got her framed picture with Rod.
The question I have to ask is, what have you got on your walls?
In my office, my pride of place picture on my is me, Martin Scorsese, Robert De Niro.
Okay, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Your first job, as I understand it, was reading the news on MTV. How did you get it?
Just before I finished uni, I used my last student grant to go and do a presenter training course, which the reason I did it was because at the end of it, you got a showreel. I went, packed my bags, went to London, stayed with friends of ours down there for the first 6 months. Thank you, Val and Ken. And then whilst I was there, I was sending it out to everybody. My mum's still got the folder of kind of rejection letters where a lot of them say, maybe you could have some elocution lessons.
Are you serious? Mm. Because heaven forfend, anybody should have a Scottish accent.
And so I was like, I'm not changing my accent because it's me. It's who I am. And then thankfully it worked in my favour because Christine Bohr, who was brought on board to launch MTV UK, and she wanted to represent the UK with her choice of, you know, VJs, as we were called. I mean, not only great accents, but great women. So there was June Sarpong, myself, Kat Deely, Donna Eyre, Sarah Cox. And we all started at MTV together. You know, that was our ticket. That was our introduction. And it was amazing. I couldn't believe someone was celebrating my kind of my voice, really.
That is an amazing collection of women when you consider where they've all gone on to. I know that Kat remains a strong friend of yours. And you ended up doing a travel series together. Purely out of drunkenness and thinking it would be a good idea if you could get someone to commission.
And they did.
I think it's a brilliant story. And they did. When you started on MTV, how old were you?
22.
The music industry, you know, it can be quite full on, quite druggy.
Yeah.
A lot of booze. Was it a challenge not to get dragged in or did you just go for it? Did you burn the many candles at all their various ends?
I burned the candles to an extent. When I was little, I had epilepsy. And so I had, when I was 6 months old, I had my first seizure. And so I was on medication up until I was about nine. And then I was weaned off it, you know, and touch wood, been fine since. It's almost been my kind of safety latch in that
a sense that there might be some form of mortality knocking around.
Well, just kind of like, don't go too mental. I've always been slightly cautious and scared about drugs and things like that because of that sort of side of things. But I mean, there was a time where, there's definitely a space and time where I have very little memory of, you know, Kat and I in particularly, we just had the best time and I drank a lot of Jack Daniels. And then weirdly, sort of once I had my first kid, Rudy, so he's 12, 13, a couple of months, kind of really changed how I felt in my relationship with alcohol.
It does that, doesn't it?
Because it had to.
There is nothing worse than doing the 5 o'clock, 5:30 wake up with a baby with a hangover.
Oh my God.
And we've all done it.
Yeah.
How are you doing on your starter?
It's lovely.
When you're ready, move on to your main. Not that I want to rush you through this.
No, it's good.
Have you gone for both the brisket and the pork, or have you just done one?
I've got a bit of brisket just now. I thought I'd have a bit of that first, and then I've got the pork belly just standing by, kind of winking at me, pretty much.
They work rather well.
Oh my God, so tender. I tried to cut the brisket and it literally just kind of melted onto the chopping board. It's so delicious.
It really is. Mm. It's really, really good.
Oh, yeah.
It has to be said, you married, your other half is in the editors.
Yeah.
That kind of cements your role in the music business, doesn't it? Have you been on tour with the editors?
Yeah, I love going on tour. And we take the kids on tour as well. It is, I've got to say. I mean, that was one of the last things that we did, actually, before lockdown. We went out to, the boys and I got on a plane to Madrid and met Tom in Madrid and went on the bus with him for 3 days. We did Madrid, Barcelona, and might have been Seville, actually. And that's been the most amazing thing to do with them in terms of introducing them to different countries, different cultures, different foods, all that kind of thing as well. It's been absolutely wonderful because you have kids on the tour bus. They're up early. You've got to get them off there before they wake everybody else up. So it kind of forced us to get out and explore and go and see things. But I loved going on tour. I did America, did the UK, did Europe. Yeah, so good.
And would you be on the edge of the stage every night?
I'd be somewhere in the venue. Yeah, I'd always have... Photography's always been a bit of a hobby of mine, so I've always got my camera with me, so I'd be running around either at the sound desk out front taking pictures, or I like being in the crowd. It's so different. The sound side of stage is rubbish.
Yes,
you have to be out front to kind of feel that energy and feel that atmosphere. I had such a weird experience this week. So I was interviewing the composer, Emil Maris, who's done this beautiful film called Minari. It's a Korean film. It's beautiful. It's been nominated for loads of great things so far this year. And so I had some time with Emil for my podcast, Soundtracking. And so we're chatting away, having a lovely time. He's created something really quite special. And then I say goodbye and, like, be great to keep in touch. And, you know, when you can, you've got to come across and do a live performance of the score at the Barbican, you know, with the film. And then his publicist, Lana, emailed me straight away going, I can't believe he didn't mention it. I'm like, what? Oh, God, what is it? And if the location was like... He was on tour with editors back in 2010 in his band, The Dig, and he was desperate to tell you, but he was also really shy about telling you. And I was like, oh my God. So I was like, please give him my email address so he can. So then he did. And so, yeah, so it's a small world.
It is a small world. Now, you've mentioned Soundtracking, which I've been listening to for the past week. If you haven't listened to it, you should.
Oh, thank you.
Because it's an amazing podcast. First of all, the impulse to launch it. So you've had a career where you've worked on Radio 2, 5, 6, 1. You presented Tea in the Park. You've been part of the Glastonbury presentation team. You've done all this big stuff. And then you decide to launch your own podcast relatively early compared to a lot of us Johnny-come-latelys like me who are just basically leaping on your coattails. What was it? Why? Why did you want to do this?
Because I wasn't able to get a regular slot on a traditional radio station. I was doing a sort of sporadic slot on Six Music, which was in one of those slots that's seasonal.
Wasn't that infuriating?
Frustrating.
I don't want to say paid your dues or all of that, but you've done it. You're a very, very experienced, accomplished broadcaster. And the idea that you don't have that slot must have been frustrating.
It was absolutely frustrating. And it's also, you have to accept that not everybody's going to like you. Not everybody's going to like what you do. That's fine. That's their choice. You can't, same in a relationship, you can't make someone change their mind and stuff. But you can't create a slot that's not there sort of thing. So I got it, but it was infuriating. And so Ben and I were like, well, why don't we do it ourselves? Why don't we try and see? And I'd just worked with Adam Buxton at Six Music. I'd worked with Adam for 6 months. We were supposed to cover for 6 weeks on this show, and we ended up doing 6 months together. And it was an amazing learning experience. Because Adam's, you know, he's talk about people who are there at the start. He was very much there at the start.
Well, yes, he really was.
He was a great kind of champion in terms of getting started. And so I reached out to the film companies. I was like, look, I'm thinking of launching a show. We're going to call it Soundtrack, and where I speak to film creatives about their relationship with music. And amazingly, Disney gave me some time with Jon Favreau, who was launching Jungle Book, his live action version of Jungle Book at the time. And so once we kind of got that in the bag, it was... It made things slightly easier in terms of we could then go to people, go, look, we've got Jon Favreau. We never, ever intended that it would be something that we would be able to do every week, which we have done since August 2016, bar 2 weeks.
Which is extraordinary.
So proud of it.
Hello, it's Ollie here. I'm the executive producer on Out to Lunch. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, one of the relationships I'm proudest of in my life is with my daughters. They're not quite the age to go for fancy lunches with celebs yet, but we do enjoy our family dinners together in relative harmony. You know, give us time, that they are still quite young. But this takes work, and it's a mistake to think that relationships have to be easy to be right. The best relationships come out of learning to live with each other and keeping our sense of humour, even when food is spilt all over the table or dinner's not to everyone's liking. It can be really tricky, but therapy can help you with those skills. You can work through parenting challenges, explore seeing eye to eye as a couple, and work through your relationship with yourself too. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's flexible, and you can switch therapists at any time, as that's a relationship that needs to be the right fit too. Become your own soulmate, whether you're looking for one or not. Visit betterhelp.com/outtolunch today and get 10% off your first month.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
You mentioned your picture, your prize picture of you and Scorsese and De Niro. I think you were once asked, you know, who would you like to say sorry to, and said it was Scorsese because you may have been... What happened? Do you tell this story?
So it was a couple of years ago, the whole kind of Irishman tour rolled into town, and you know, they were all here promoting the film, and it was around BAFTA time as well, you know, kind of For Your Considerations, all those Q&As. And I was asked to host the premiere, which I did, which was incredible. And then I got asked to host a Q&A with them all. So it was, I mean, it was crazy. It was, you know, Harvey Keitel, Al Pacino, Sandy Powell, the costume designer, Emma Koskoff, the producer, Steve, the writer, De Niro, Scorsese. And they put Scorsese right next to me. He's very warm. He's very kind of open. He's not one of those people that you feel scared to talk to. He was really generous. And so I kept doing this thing where I kept like, because we were so close, because there were so many of us on this small stage.
I mean, that's an enormous Q&A panel. It's not ideal to do a Q&A with seven people and, or whatever it was.
Yeah, it was crazy. And so I just kept doing this thing where we were chatting and then he would say something and it would be funny. And so I'd do that thing, that familiar thing, like tapping him on the shoulder going, oh, Marty, stop it. And so I just like hadn't realised how much I'd done it through the course of the Q&A. I'm like, God, the poor man's going to have like a bruise on his shoulder, if nothing else.
Did you say anything to him at the end or scurry off hoping never to broach the subject of your tactile engagement with him?
Well, they were kind of swept off in a kind of wind of A-list celebrityness. And then I didn't really get a chance to apologise to him, but Emma, the producer, who I then spoke to a couple of weeks later for the podcast, because she's an extraordinary woman, because she's worked with Martin Scorsese for a number of years, and then she worked with Todd Phillips on The Joker. So she had these two films at the same time kind of, you know, battling out for awards. But, and I said, I'm so, so sorry. Please, can you pass on my apologies to Mr. Scorsese? She was like, oh, don't be daft. She's like, he loves it. You know, he's got granddaughters who are about your age. So he feels really comfortable with someone who knows what they're talking about, but being kind of, you know, friendly with him. I was like, oh God, it's a kind of maybe a bit too much. And then I told the story to Robert De Niro as well. And it's like, it was almost like I carried a watermelon moment from, you know, Dirty Dancing. I got asked about a month down the line, Robert De Niro flew into London for one night to do a Q&A for The Irishman. He was so passionate about this film. And they asked me if I would host it. I was like, are you kidding? Of course. So we're in this weird little corridor waiting to go on. And I don't, that kind of weird small, I mean, doing small talk at the best times is hard. But doing small talk with Robert De Niro was like, what do you say? So then I was like, oh, I'll just tell him how much I embarrassed myself with Martin Scorsese, where he was actually sat next to him. He just kind of nodded like that, did that kind of De Niro kind of...
With the turned down mouth,
yeah.
De Niro nod.
Yeah.
Which you're doing very well to me now. The producer of today's fine podcast, Selena, who you know and have worked with, told me a great story, which was in 2015... You both went to interview Keanu Reeves and told him that he really ought to do a sequel or a third along the way to Bill and Ted. He was asking you if it was really a good idea. Is that correct?
That is correct. And people can hear it somewhere, I imagine. Yeah, I just have such a happy experience of Bill and Ted. And it's one of those things where you wonder whether he's embarrassed to... At the time, you kind of couldn't quite gauge whether it's something that he was really proud of or he didn't want to talk about. He did. We weren't told we couldn't ask him about it. So it was like, well, I love Bill and Ted. I'd love to see, where are they now? You know, what are they doing now? You know, Bodacious, all that stuff. And so I was like, I'm going to ask him. And yeah, and that was before it was announced that they were doing the new film.
So I think
Selena and I are the reason that there was the sequel to, yeah. I think it's our fault.
Bogus Journey. It's your fault. Well, it's pretty. I have a quick Keanu Reeves story. When I was on the One Show, which I no longer am, we'd have ridiculous big names would fly in, and you could always measure them out by the size of their entourage. So Will Smith was 7 4x4s, 28 people taking over the grid. I mean, it was insane, absolutely insane. Whereas Keanu Reeves turned up in a car by himself. There was nobody. Got out the car, said, where do I go?
Yeah.
Walked into makeup, took one look at me and went, hey, man, it's you. Because he'd become a big fan of the cooking show I'd done in LA.
Amazing. So
that's my absolute joyous, you know, if Keanu Reeves story.
I've had that with the most unexpected people. Leonardo DiCaprio. Where?
Oh, really?
You'd expect if anybody's going to turn up with a massive entourage... It's going to be Leo.
Yeah.
No. He came into the room, sat down on his own, didn't have anybody there keeping time. And the other thing is that he engaged and that he wanted to have a conversation. He wasn't there to just answer the questions. And I really remember that about him. And I was really grateful for that as well, because it's quite hard sometimes to snap people out of that kind of junket. They're in those rooms for hours on end and they're being asked the same questions, and they've prepared loads of answers to the questions as well. You know, they've done a couple of days training on what could be the potential questions being asked. And that's kind of what I like about with soundtracking, is that I'm not asking the same questions because I'm not interested in that line of questioning. I want to talk about music. I want to talk about the creativity. I love how I can see it almost... When I say, oh, if no one's told them in advance, and I go, so we're going to talk about music, their shoulders almost drop. You get a different interview, you get a more truthful interview, and they can be themselves. But Leo was extraordinary. I couldn't believe it.
On that note, I am going to suggest a quick break while I run downstairs. You've been much more together about this.
I'm going to stick mine. I do have a microwave, and I'm going to stick mine in the microwave.
But so mine's in the oven, and I need to just go and sort it out. I'll see you in a couple of minutes.
Okay.
Ta-da! Oh, pretty.
My favourite bit.
What, the sticky toffee pudding loaf? Are you big on a pudding?
Love a sticky toffee pudding.
I think we say thank you again to Smokestack for this.
Thank you so much.
You've said you're not a film critic, and you seem to delight in me suggesting you're a super fan. But, Edith, I have to ask you, there must be things you hate. There must be films you sat in and thought, this is pants.
There are films that I don't particularly like. Hate's quite a...
It's a strong word.
It is a strong word. And I don't know, I'm that annoying to a lot of people person who tries to see the glass half full. So I always kind of try and go into things with, you know, kind of with no clouded judgment, really, which can be hard a lot of the time, you know, because of social media and research and stuff that I already know about the film or the cast and things like that. And I sometimes think that that's the thing with film, in terms of there are some films that are made for specific audiences. And if you're not that audience, you need to watch it with that audience. Like, I remember I was covering for Simon Mayo and Kermode and Mayo once, and we were reviewing one of the Fast and Furious films. Now, to be honest, I kind of clocked out after the third film. I was like, do we need any more? But I think it was like number seven. And so I was like, okay, right. So I remember phoning my friend Nathan, and who I knew was well into it. I was like, Nate, can we go and see Fast and Furious? There's a late night screening at The View on Finchley Road. Let's go and watch it there. So we went. It was like a 11:30 screening, and it was rammed with proper Fast and Furious fans. You know, they had the mobile phones out. They were like, not filming the film, but like taking selfies, getting into it and whooping. And I walked out the film kind of going, that was awesome. And it was a combination, I think, of the whole event of it, really, and being in that environment with those fans where you're kind of like, it was really infectious.
There's a famously a moment when you were sitting in for Kermode and Mayo with Robbie Collins, yeah, and you sort of had a row, oh, yeah, over Jojo Rabbit. Yeah. One of you hated it, one of you liked it.
Loved it. He hated it.
Oh, he's wrong.
Isn't he?
I think it's a fabulous
Isn't
film.
It?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's absolutely wrong. Yeah, 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 yeah.
I watched it with my 12-year-old as well, and it was the most brilliant historical discussion piece to then go and talk about the Holocaust and the personal aftermath of that and World War II. You know, and I think that coming in through the eyes of a child into that world, it was so clever. I almost feel like the defender when I'm on that show as well. You know, even if the film's not that great, I kind of feel like I've got to be the other side if it's being panned by someone.
Now, listen, one of the other things I want to talk to you about before I let you get on with your life as lunch comes to an end. You have been presenting the podcast Tied to the Crown,
yeah,
the Netflix series. Now, we are talking, at the exact moment we're talking, there is still an enormous amount of fallout from the Meghan and Harry interview with Oprah. So if anybody wants to, can work out when we're talking. I don't know if you saw the interview, but you must have been following some of the coverage. It's pure Crown, isn't it? It's that drama being worked out again in real life.
With doing the Crown podcast, I spend a lot of time with a lot of the people behind the scenes. So Peter Morgan, who writes it, Annie Salzberger, who's the head of research, the producers, the directors. But obviously it's Peter's creative interpretation of that world. But the thing that he always says is that when he's writing it, everything has to come back to the Crown. Everything has to come back to the Queen. Everything that Harry said with regards to, you know, him being trapped and all the other things, duty is the first and foremost. The thing that's the most upsetting about the whole thing is the race side of things. And the idea that someone would be made to feel that way, you know.
Even if you take race out of the equation, the replaying of the story of Diana is quite extraordinary. When you've been doing The Crown and talking to Peter, is he prepared to show his workings in the margins?
I've spoken to him about it, and he's very conscious about the responsibility that he feels to Harry and William with this programme moving forward, because that what they've been through already has just been, you know, excruciating for two young boys and young men to go through. And he feels like he has a sense of duty to them.
Has he given any indication whether that means that Harry and William will be removed from the narrative, or is he just being
I don't think
very,
they can be. I don't think they can be. I think that, you know, it's interesting that he's decided to do two last seasons as opposed to, it was only supposed to be one more. And then he announced before the last season aired that there was going to be two more. I think he said in the podcast, you know, he knows where it needs to end. And it's not coming up to present day. It's not anywhere near that. That's one of the things that I always find so sad about it. None of them had their mums and dads around.
I know, it's bizarre, isn't it?
It's really odd. You know, I remember in one of those scenes from the last season, Olivia Colman, you know, as the Queen, when they were having a conversation around the table about Diana insisting on taking William on this Australian tour. And she said, oh, you know, Philip and I were away for 5 months sort of thing. And it's kind of like as if that was kind of all right.
And everybody worked out fine, didn't they? Look, it has been brilliant sharing lunch
you
with you.
Too.
I'm really grateful for you taking the time. It's been lovely. Thank you for staying in for lunch with me.
Oh, please. I hope we can do it in person at some point in the future.
Well, yeah. No, that would be good, wouldn't it? Myself and the wonderful Edith Bowman feasted on a smokestack at home DIY kit, including salt-baked beetroot, goat's cheese and hazelnut, slow-cooked brisket and pork belly and sticky toffee pudding. Smokestack is in London's Shoreditch. Please do go and look them up. It's fabulous. Both Soundtracking and The Crown are available wherever you get your podcasts. And whilst you're there, do dive into the Out to Lunch archive. There is so much to enjoy. Rate us, give us 5 stars, comment on your favourite Out to Lunch episode and follow us to receive a fresh helping as soon as it is ready. Out to Lunch is a Something Else and Jay Rayner production. The music was written, arranged and performed by me, Jay Rayner, and Robert Regenberg. The recording and mix engineer was Josh Gibbs. Jemima Rathbone was assistant producer. The producer is Selena Ream and the executive producer is Darby Doris. Additional production is from Steve Ackerman. Next time is the Scottish stand-up comedian, an author who told Donald Trump exactly what she thought of him, and it wasn't pretty. It's Janie Godley.
They were not prepared for a comedian. So they kept saying things like, you can't have that word. And I'm like, what about unt? And they were debating the word. And I'm like, guys, I'm fucking joking. I'm not going to put my hand over the sea.